Okay.
We are now going to discuss two papers on macro hedging. Jane Hurwitz is going to tee off. It's going to be her first presentation, so we will be nice. Jane.
Two papers will be presented at this session. Each one's going to focus on one of the 11 steps outlined in the November 2011 board meeting. Both papers cover specific aspects of the revaluation model, which has been discussed at various board meetings during the year. The discussions so far have focused on a revaluation model where macro hedging activity for interest rate risk is undertaken by banks. Many detailed aspects of the model have been discussed at board meetings, but at a high level, the revaluation model results in a revaluation adjustment for interest rate risk from hedged amortized cost exposures where the interest rate risk is managed on a portfolio basis. Such an adjustment should provide an offset to the movement from fair values in hedging derivatives. We'll start with Agenda Paper 4A. This raises the question as to whether internal derivatives between a banking book and a trading book should play a role in the revaluation model. Banks usually have separate ALM or group treasury and trading units. They may both use similar instruments, but their business models are very different with respect to interest rate risk positions. Group Treasury's aim is to stabilise an interest margin from banking book activity, and trading desks want to generate fair value profits. This paper discusses a mechanism using internal derivatives to reflect those different business models in the consolidated financial statements. This is achieved by applying a revaluation model to the interest rate risk position for which risk management activity is undertaken without regard to the ever-changing trading book. This includes where internal derivatives are used to transfer risk between the trading book and the banking book. Trading activities would still be at fair value through P&L. A key consideration in this discussion is whether it is useful information for the financial statements to reflect the business models within the bank or purely an external perspective. We're not making a proposal to change the fact that the fair value from banking book and trading book internal derivatives will net to nil in the income statement. However, there will be an indirect impact by the internal derivatives facilitating a change in some of the amortised cost amounts in the balance sheet for which a revaluation adjustment may be passed. In addition, internal derivatives may have a role to play in the presentation of business activities in the income statement. Presenting fair value changes from trading book internal derivatives within a trading income line and fair value changes for banking book internal derivatives within a non-trading income line may provide a better, clearer information on the business activities of the bank. With this, I turn it over to the board for discussion.
When I agree to this proposal, because my internal derivatives, mine clearly has to be net to nil in the consolidated statements, but it isn't kind of mean where you can really better show what is going on in the bank. And how it was explained, it is, I think, also in the classification measurement model, we distinguish between really the banking book, which is at cost, and the trading book or fair value through profit per P&L. And if we allow really that how a bank is operating, which is through internal derivatives, then bringing risk, interest rate risk out of the banking book into the trading book, I think internal derivatives is a medium to allow us to make that more transparent, and so I'm in favor of that.
Can I ask a question on that? So I agree it makes it more transparent, but you could manage this in other ways. And so the question to me is not so much whether we should take note of internal derivatives, but whether we should take note of the model and whether that risk that's not covered should be fair value. That you may not need to do internal derivatives to come to that decision.
No, but I think maybe, but when we have the current, I think, macro hedge model, which I think also achieves set in some regard, but what it really does not, the current model, is really to reflect how risk management is doing that, because it is not allowed to have any, then internal derivatives are used, you have also to demonstrate it is an external derivative in place, and that leads to the current situation where external derivatives are designated, de-designated, and what you're really doing is you're losing really the link between really what risk management, interest rate risk management in the bank is doing and how you account for that. And I think this new model, the benefits of that, you link more really risk management activities and what is then presented in the financial statements. So I agree what you said, you don't need it, but it is a better way if you allow that really to demonstrate how risk management, interest rate risk management in the banking book is performed in the bank.
I found it conceptually very interesting. In the examples, it suggests that there potentially would be some very useful information for investors in this model. My primary concern at the moment is that we aren't going to be able to find a way to display that information in a way that is actually useful. So that we talk about it being more transparent, and in a sense it is, but when you put it into a big entity with lots of moving pieces, I'm not sure that the information that we think we're making transparent doesn't get lost. I don't see how that transparency is going to make itself known in the consolidated financial statements at the end of the day. But I think if we could make it transparent, it would provide useful information.
Philippe?
I think the benefits of this information is pretty much, for me, in relation to segment reporting. Internal derivatives are just about transferring a risk management activity from one part of the business to another one, from the banking book people to the trading book or to the central treasury management. And that is okay, and that is very important to users, I think. Then, I think the best way to show it is to show the profitability of the banking activity, of the trading activity, or the central treasury activity if it is a profit center. And that would mean to me to show the results by segment. So I think the end of this full process is to think in terms of segment reporting in a way.
And in segment reporting, you are allowed to show those.
I would say if you have an activity which is internal, which is transferring cost or profits from one part of the business to another one, I would expect it to show up in the segment reporting.
If that's the way you report to management.
That's a problem. If you have an internal derivative activity and you don't have a segment reporting which shows up who does what, then we have a big issue, I think, in terms of trying to communicate this information outside of segment reporting or inconsistently, in a way inconsistent with segment reporting. Then I think that creates confusion.
But you would really expect that to show up in
how they report to management. As Paul is saying, it might not be the way it is reported externally. Then I don't know how to do it. That's more,
yeah. Amaro?
Makes sense. I guess one point is I really like the paper. It's an excellent paper. Facilitate my understanding on this. I was a little bit confused with the word revaluation, but I guess you clarified properly that we are not changing the final number in the P&L. We are actually, it's a matter of geography and acknowledge the use of internal derivatives. And I guess I do agree with that, if our objective is to have a model that better portray the risk management activities into accounting. I guess this is one of the alternatives. Just remind ourselves that this is not limited to banks. I've learned during this process that also other groups of entities that are not only banks, bank type, they do have similar type of internal management with derivatives. And I do have a question, and maybe you have the experience on that, is what we are actually proposing here, and of course is one of almost the final step of this, our study for a potential DP later on, I guess the entities, not to mention concentrate on banks, entities that do use this strategy or risk management strategy, although even today they don't have an accounting requirement to provide this information, they are probably disclosing that as a source of non-GAAP information, either to the presentation to the analyst or in a disclosure to the financial statement. Because if they do have this structure, if it's for their own benefit, they have an interest in disclosing that.
Well, whatever is this information that management thinks is essentially explaining the performance but doesn't find a way into GAAP typically ends up as non-GAAP information because you still need to provide information to communicate. So that's.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify the no effect.
The only camera you don't point well is the one directed to you.
Yeah, I don't look so good on camera. The statement that would have no effect on profit and loss is just a little bit confusing to me. I understand the elimination of internal derivatives on consolidation, but as I understand it, you're transferring that risk out of amortized cost in your banking book across to trading, and then you'll fair value that risk. So that would have to have an effect on your profit and loss, wouldn't it?
The question is, what is your comparative yardstick or your starting point that you compare it against when you say, is there a change or not? Obviously, if there is in the consolidated financial statements no revaluation of any amortized cost asset for interest rate risk, then first you need to get some revaluation because otherwise you cannot show anything. You will just have the accounting mismatch that you started with and nothing happens. I don't think that having internal derivatives is necessary to come to this revaluation model that we've developed, hence why this is the first paper about internal derivatives. Because if somebody did not have internal derivatives but directly had this net position of items subject to interest rate risk and used directly external derivatives already at the banking book level, then so far in this project we would also say, well, revalue your interest rate risk position, you have your derivatives that go fair value through profit or loss anyway, and then you can see what the open position is, and that goes through profit or loss if it is not a closed position. So that change from amortized cost to the revalued amount is not dependent on whether somebody uses or doesn't use internal derivatives, but the fact that they have internal derivatives is usually a very good indicator that they are managing these interest rate risk positions on a fair value basis. In that direction, I think it is relevant. Then, once you say you revalue that external position, then the internal derivatives are really more this income statement gross up or presentation thing that you say, if I'm of the view that in this structure, leaving the banking book unhedged is tantamount to trading, albeit via a different way, then I have no such need or I enter into a trading derivative externally, then actually using the internal derivatives as we in this fourth approach have envisaged here would allow you to compare entities that both trade, that have the same level of trading activity. It's just that the one entity can use an open banking book and the other entity might have to use something else.
Can I try to explain it maybe in different words? When I see it, hedge accounting is a kind of an option because, man, you are living in the banking book an amortized cost model. And if this paper is shown, if you have, for example, a fixed rate loan with a variable liability, which is funding this fixed rate loan, you have an open interest rate risk. Under the amortized cost model, it is not shown in the financials. It's not disclosed, it's not shown, because we are an amortized cost model. If you're now allowing macro hedge accounting, for me it is not different if you're allowing the company to give an option to show this kind of interest rate gap which you have. And that is be done through internal derivatives, because you transfer that then into the trading book, and it is shown then, because the trading book is fair value through profit and loss, you show that interest rate gap into the trading book. And therefore, answering your question, yes, it has an impact, because macro hedging is a kind of option, because it is not mandatory. It is an option for a company to use that, and if you're using hedge accounting, then you're changing measurement.
That's very interesting, huh? Because in IFRS 9, you first say, well, you look at your business model, and then, well, it's to hold and collect contractual cash flows, so it's amortized cost. But then, one of the biggest risks that we have, we completely, our business model is to manage that on a fair value basis.
But on a fair value basis.
A particular risk, and it is a partial fair value basis, but nonetheless, I think quite a chunk. And even credit risks are also partially managed at a fair value basis through the derivatives, and possibly macro hedge accounting might come into effect there too. So then if we introduce this, which I find intellectually plausible, we eat away a lot of that original business model. And
I think we actually provide all the bits to show it better. So I think you need, if you're not into trading activity, if you don't have amortized costs as a starting platform, I doubt that you would get ever to a clean and meaningful interest revenue, interest expense number. And the recent IFRIC discussions actually have shown right that. So that's why you need a starting point. And then I think it's really a big difference whether you have something that you look at by item and its entire fair value, or whether you look at huge portfolios by risk. And this by risk view, actually, with this transaction structure we've described in the paper, is where you manage, call it on a fair value basis, or a current value basis, a risk, but it does not actually contradict the fact that you hold those items in those portfolios for long times to collect those cash flows. So I don't see that as a contradiction. It's just a more transparent way to show how, despite usually holding onto those assets, they still manage those risks.
Yeah, just managing some of the risks on the cash flows you're going to collect.
Yeah.
So I think it is consistent with our amortized cost.
Yes.
Yes. What the banking book, well, the people in charge of banking book, they are managing a portfolio of assets and liabilities, yes. Not only assets.
Yes.
And because there is not a full matching of the fixed rate position or variable rate position, partly they have a mismatch between fixed rate and variable rates, they need to have this kind of strategy to hedge this variable rate or this fixed rate, which is not fully aligned. And is that
I see the necessity for
what they are doing is fixing an interest rate margin. It's all about fixing a margin,
yeah.
Which is not inconsistent with having an amortized cost model, I think.
I want to go back to the issue that Ian raised about its effects on the financial statements, the revaluation. So if you have a treasury function and you're using internal derivatives and we use revaluation, if the trading function then lays off that risk externally, you have that external derivative matching the change in the value of the interest rate risk in your banking book. If you're using this model and the trading function decides not to lay that risk off to a third party, in other words, they decide to be exposed, then the banking book would, under this model, would still revalue that risk position, and there would be more volatility or in P&L than there would be without this methodology. Is that correct?
No.
Yeah, that's correct.
No, it's not correct.
Yes, and there it would also diverge from what a regular amortized cost presentation would give.
No, it's not correct, because to clarify that, if you don't allow in your example, if you don't allow derivatives, internal derivatives to be reflected, then you will not show anything in the financial accounts because it is in the amortized cost model, you will not see any volatility. If you allow internal derivatives, then you will see in the banking book that, okay, there is also nothing happened. But as I said, that is a hedge accounting kind of option, but you will see this volatility in the trading book because you have through internal derivatives.
I don't think you're contradicting yourself. I think that looks right to bottom line PL. Is there more volatility if you don't hedge it out after you chose to do such a revaluation approach? I think yes, there is. And your point is just that in my banking book part of the income statement, I'm still flat because I hedged the trading book. But in the trading book now, the volatility comes in because they didn't hedge it out.
You see it, right.
Exactly.
And
so
if you then, it's when, okay, maybe I have misunderstood
it. That's exactly.
But it's also a fairly unlikely scenario that this would completely.
The good thing is that whether it's likely or not, you will see it.
Yes.
So that's the important thing. We don't need to tell people it's likely or not.
What I haven't decided yet is whether the trading book is the right place to see it or not. But so my question is, you were comparing this to someone who didn't have a treasury function before when you started answering Ian's question. And so someone that didn't have a treasury function and wasn't using internal derivatives would put on a derivative if they wanted to lay the risk off externally, and we would do our general hedge accounting model. But if they chose not to lay it off externally, then we wouldn't see the change in the risk. So only when they chose to hedge the risk and there was hedge ineffectiveness, would we see anything in the financial statements if someone didn't have a treasury function or wasn't using this model?
I don't think that is the case. I think the fact whether you revalue your amortized cost positions for interest rate risk in this case also depend on whether you say that's how I'm going to communicate with my audience. I have hedging activity or trading activity, doesn't matter, but I use external derivatives sometimes to lay off at least part of that risk. And then you would see in the same way that if you revalue that amortized cost book for interest rate risk, to what extent that occurs at any point in time. The only thing that is missing here is that they, because of the organizational structure, then would not have a clear distinction between banking book and trading because their structure is a different one.
So are you suggesting that any entity that has a risk management policy of managing its interest rate risk on its amortized cost assets would revalue the amortized cost assets for interest rate risk changes in any period, regardless of whether they had an offsetting derivative position?
Yeah, I think what the paper says is if you wanted to, you could contemplate that you do an externalization test and you only allow that if they largely externalize or whatever. You get into the problem of finding where large is large enough. And also, the most interesting ones for the users are actually the ones that have a lot of variation in how much they hedge.
Mm-hmm.
That is what creates the most information need, and if you now switch it on and off, you would actually not see that. Because then you'd only have this waterline accounting that if they hedge more, you allow them to neutralize more. If they hedge less, you see not this revaluation anymore. And so it looks like they're always basically having offsetting changes for the derivative, but the open position that they vary, you wouldn't see. So I think that would completely not allow a user the insight of how much they actually, from time to time, hedge. And so that's why I think when you manage something together as one unit, that needs to be revalued over time. You can't switch it on, switch it off. And if you did that, you get into this discontinuation accounting, all the complexities, you ultimately end up without a macro model. So you have to really make a very fundamental decision how you communicate with your audience, and that will be driven by how you manage that kind of activity.
So this would be totally separate from whether someone has a treasury function and is actually using internal derivatives.
I think you would have a quite natural incentive for people to not choose that if they don't use derivatives to at least externalize some risk. And then I think you can talk about whether we want to make any qualifying criteria, like it needs to be managed on an interest rate risk basis in a certain way. But I think it does not depend on whether you have internal derivatives or whether you call your organizational unit group treasury or not. That doesn't matter. It's more actually what instruments do you use for what purpose.
Okay.
Jan?
Well, I'll start by saying that I don't think I fully understand this. And that's, of course, very embarrassing after so many educational sessions. So, but I think we are trying to solve different problems here. And as I have understood, one of the problems with this is that if we have, let's call it a normal business, you have a few transactions and you can follow the transactions and you can see that I had this transaction, I made that other transaction to offset risks or whatever. And here we have massive volumes and we have sort of big portfolios and they are moving all the time. And I think that is one problem. And I think we should focus first to solve that, because there we have a lot of need of solving it. The present way we are doing hedging doesn't really make it easy to do these transparent things. And coming out of Sweden, we used to have in Swedish GAAP, we had sort of portfolio hedging. I wasn't aware of that, but we did that because it was a very practical way of solving things. And now we also talk about, Philip, for example, about segment reporting, and we talk about, like Pat is doing, about we will get new type of information. And I think we should try to keep these two things apart. I am personally a little bit worried about us saying that we make a model whereby if I move from my banking book to my trading book, a risk, I get a different type of accounting. But even though you are saying that we must stick to what we have, there will be sort of possibilities of varying how much you move in and move out. So there will always be that possibility. So without fully understanding where this leads, I think it's very good that we are finally moving our hedge accounting in line with the risk management and the way people are managing. If it doesn't show up in segment reporting, that's something else. But people will anyhow be able to explain how they're managing their risks and how they are calculating the performance of different parts of the book. And also when we go into oil traders or food processors, we will also find that there are companies today that are really in need of a solution like this. So let's move it on.
Yeah. Stephen?
So let me test if I understand. If you do lay off all of the risk externally, then there's no difference between using this macro model as presented and the general hedge model, other than the macro model would be operationally easier and it would change the segment number, so it would change the amount reported in the banking book and the trading book. If it's fully laid off.
If it's fully laid off.
And you can identify the general hedge model and pick an asset to offset your derivative, then you get the same answer.
If you assume that you get that sorted on a general hedge accounting and do this monstrous effort, then yes, that's what would get you. I didn't understand your point why it would be different for segment reporting, though.
Well, obviously you have flexibility at the moment about how you report the performance of the banking book versus the trading book, so it wouldn't necessarily change it, but it would certainly, with these internal derivatives, the way you've structured the paper, it would seem that you end up with the volatility within the trading book and therefore highlighted and shown more clearly, perhaps you could argue. Where it would be different is in the case of not fully laying it off. Either you didn't externalize it at all or you did it partially. And then it seems to me we've got two quite different systems of accounting. There's a multi, under the general model, it'll be amortized cost with a revaluation of interest rate risk to the extent that you've you've hedged.
Yes.
Whereas under this model, it'll be amortized cost with the revaluation for interest rate risk for every asset. Although you haven't talked about portfolios, I guess this might be on or off for different portfolios.
I would assume this is by a portfolio level basis. So what is managed together? That is your decision basis.
Okay, so within one entity, we have faced the prospect of having effectively two different systems of accounting. So my concern is how understandable this is going to be when we make the macro model optional, we make the general model optional, and how many, and then we do it by portfolio and how many different permutations we could end up with in terms of banks reporting. So my question, firstly, is my analysis right? And secondly, how would we enable a user to understand the implication of the macro, the general, not hedge accounting, and it being done on a portfolio basis?
In terms of permutations, I think the permutations depend on how many different activities you have. If you all have activities of one kind, then you would end up probably applying the same kind of approach across the board. But you can obviously have quite different activities. In one country, you run large books combined with trading. In others, you do not do it all. You might just be running off a rather stable book and hedge that out until it is run off. Then I don't see why there's a necessity to present them in the same way. Now, obviously, you can always say in the discussion paper, we contemplate that actually we should use an if-then design, that just not describing it as a qualifying criteria for, say, portfolio-level accounting policy choice, that if that is your circumstance, then you can elect this treatment. You could say, well, if that is your circumstance, then you shall elect that treatment. That's obviously what you can say. I think I said it even when we had general hedge accounting, and then you obviously all said, nah, rather not. But obviously, I think that is worth something if you're so keen about it to be tested. Generally, one of the biggest problems is if you have an entity with 300 billion in the balance sheet, whatever accounting you do is necessarily quite difficult to capture this whole big thing in just some numbers. So I think this one would actually be much better than how people today try to help themselves with general hedge accounting, because it is actually this dynamic context that they have. And also, well, as I said, if they use not hedging out their banking book as an alternative for the trading activity, why not show it like that? So I don't see your problem that under general hedge accounting, you can only, because you need to match items in a hedging relationship, do it basically on a basis that you cannot do much more on the one hand side than in terms of the value change you have on the other side. But that's understandable because that is this relationship that you designate. This is more a general approach that you say, I'm actually managing it on a different basis, and specifically how that varies over time is quite useful. That is from an information perspective. From an operational perspective, as I said, hedge accounting only works in this more targeted way because you need to track that hedging relationship and then have discontinuations and so on, whereas if you do that on a permanently revolving basis, obviously, it would not work. So you then actually do not have what Jan was looking for, this more operational aspect of addressing a dynamic environment.
I would answer that differently, because currently, if you are an amortized cost and you don't use any derivative, you don't see any interest rate mismatch. If you go to general hedge accounting and use one derivative, maybe eliminating a portion of that, then you get some insight about, okay, this portion which is eliminated, but the rest, we don't have any information. With then this macro hedge accounting, what we're discussing here, then I think you go from this, I think, imperfect information to a more perfect, because then, at least for a certain portfolio, where you have decided, I want to show really the interest rate risk in that portfolio, then you get this full transparency of that portfolio. So I would answer your question. Information about the interest rate mismatch is increasingly based on doing nothing, which is amortized cost metal. General hedge accounting, you get some insight, but with the macro hedge accounting, you get full insight.
Well, I'm not so sure, because if it's done on a portfolio basis, and I don't know how we would define a portfolio, but that's pretty flexible, it seems to me. I'm not sure how much comprehensive information we're going to get. What about...
Let me answer that. If you're concerned to that, then you should not allow general hedge accounting, because it's the same issue. You have the same issue.
Well,
you have to define it in the hedge documentation much more precisely than a general statement. So,
would it be possible to mandate this entity-wide policy choice, on or off? You either... are doing this for the whole entity, the whole...
What do you mean all amortized cost items need to be remeasured for?
I think we should ask that in the discussion paper.
I mean, obviously you can say you have an entity group-wide one-time policy choice to switch amortized cost items to revaluing for the interest rate risk, but then obviously that would revalue even those, if there's a diversified group, that are not at all managed in that way.
They are surely not all managed the same way.
We were talking classification measurement. This obviously interacts with that. Are we not effectively talking about a different classification? We have amortized cost assets, amortized cost revalued for interest rate risk assets.
This is partial fair value assets.
Lumps.
I wasn't going to use that term.
Call it revalued by risk, but... yes, obviously that changes the measurement. Otherwise, we would not need a standard that allows or mandates that, quite clearly.
But you have said for all hedge accounting, you have, if you are an industrial company, you have commodities which you're hedging. The commodities are amortized cost. If you use hedge accounting, you have also different measurements. So that is a general issue, I think, if you allow hedge accounting. That is
I'm thinking more about...
specific to banks and is not specific to interest rates.
Large car manufacturer, most of them, or the very large ones, run their own full-blown banking operation these days, including customer business, deposits, and all that, have a full banking license. Obviously, if they apply, for instance, this model for their banking business, then if you say group-wide, all of a sudden their finance lease receivables that finance the car sales that they might not treat in the same way, otherwise it probably end up in that banking business, all of that would also need to be revalued. Is that what was intended? If it's intended, well, then you would have to go down that route, clearly. But then you say, well, was without another entity that doesn't run a banking operation, and would I then not want the same? And then you say, well, now I have no comparability between the industrial parts of the operation. So it's a bit of a road into the Gobi Desert, I think.
We're going to lack comparability somewhere in all of this. It's just a question of where it is.
Jiang Wu.
Thank you. So based on the example of page 12, you are suggesting many approach here. I guess based on this analysis, excellent analysis of these all approaches, regardless of what internal derivatives are considered or revaluation model is applied, all the sum of all profit and loss are the same, right? They are under the alternative 1 and 2, 3, 4. Just the difference is volatility of the peers, right? So, and you are suggesting the alternative 4, that is the most, maybe least volatility of all four approaches. So I guess as Martin said, regardless of what macro hedging or revaluation model, the total sum of profit is the same. But if we accept this model, then risk management activities of banks can be represented well, because volatility is adjusted by introducing the model. But I'm responding to Stephen's whether we have to make a mandatory requirement or not, because it doesn't matter, because based on this analysis on the approach 4, all the stability, all the volatility is gone. So I guess most banks would prefer you to use this method, if they want risk management activities.
If I can just clarify, so the alternatives of approach 2, 3, and 4, they are the same in net profit or loss. It's a presentation change, income statement line items, but all of those alternatives assume that you have switched to revaluation for the interest rate risk. I think Steve's point was that he would contemplate at least an all or nothing decision of whether you can switch to revaluation for the interest rate risk. Once you've switched, it becomes a pure income statement classification issue. But obviously the bigger decision first is whether you allow people to change the measurement.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Would there be any big bank who doesn't do this to a great extent?
And this is just my personal view, and it's highly speculative because I don't still run a bank. So yeah. I think the banks will look, if you make it optional, the treatment. Will look very hard what is more important to them, communicating with shareholders in a very transparent way already in their financial statements, or focusing to keep PL volatility as low as possible because volatility spooks investors. And that'll probably result in different camps, that some say, look, we want to actually communicate and we don't beat around the bush if we are in open position, and then you probably change to this model. If people do not want to show, at least as it happens, an open position that they run, then they would try to still get by with a fragile application of general hedge accounting to the extent that they can do it, and then it's really driven by bank.
What my question was.
This was, do they manage the risks?
Are there any big banks that would not manage their risks in such a way as is described in this paper?
I have not talked to one so far that wouldn't do it like that.
I mean, and if everybody does it?
It's a capital issue. I mean, if you wanted to run a huge, completely open banking book, you don't have enough capital.
I cannot imagine that a sophisticated bank would not do it this way.
Banks are regulated, and they cannot hold this big open interest rate risk position out of the banking book.
If that is the case, then that would really plead for not an option, but an obligation. PK.
Just to understand, this is a question perhaps we need to ask in the discussion paper relating to this general hedging and macro hedging we are discussing. If I understand correctly, the way it is going, maybe we have not made a decision on that, so I'm not going to say that it is this. So I can have a portfolio under macro hedging and in a different item in the same another portfolio go for general hedging. Let's say interest rate risk. Mm-hmm. Interest rate for this risk, for this portfolio is under macro hedging, but in another portfolio, I don't want to do the whole portfolio, do the general hedging. Perhaps we need to think about whether if we go down this path, whether we should give them the choice of macro hedging and general hedging for the same type of risk in that book, or should we say, no, if you do that, you've got to go for the macro hedging for the whole thing, because this on and off that can be played to a large extent, I know we have cut it down quite a bit in the general hedging. It's not allowed into the macro hedging, because once you're on it, you're on a fair value. But on a macro hedging, on a general hedging, when the hedge expires, you can do anything you want.
I mean, I thought about whether there is a cannibalism effect or overlap or a kind of detrimental incentive to do the wrong thing. I think there is a very strong natural incentive for people to pick the right model unless they are really trying to focus on just stabilizing PL, when they would not use this revaluation model if it was optional at all. And then as a user, you get actually very valuable information from that choice that an entity makes as to how they communicate with you and what they are prepared to show to you and what they're not prepared to show to you. So I think it's first a kind of useful information, and second, depending on whether you make this optional or mandatory, I don't see that there is a lot of worrisome competition. I think it's a more natural competition that wherever it makes sense, people would use this model, actually.
But shouldn't we discuss that if after we have done the next paper? Because is related to that, because some banks have an open position, leave it. So it's different kind of how have set the limits, how you accept really the interest rate risk from that. And I think after that discussion, maybe we it's better to continue if it's mandatory or if it should be a choice.
I think you need to look hard at the overall model to then see whether it's possible to make it mandatory, and if yes, do you want to? And then it's a discussion paper. So, yeah, we don't need to come to a conclusion on that today.
No, but okay. If,
okay. Maybe then that was a sign to switch to the next paper.
I thought it was a natural bridge to the next paper.
Very nice segue. Thank
you, Michael.
Sometimes I'm constructive.
Yeah. That's one credit.
Sometimes. Don't get carried away. Can I go ahead?
Okay. No. Can I start?
Yeah.
Now, let me explain the message of Agenda Paper 4B. In considering an accounting model for macro hedging that is based on a revaluation approach, one question is what relevance risk limits might have. Some view the concept of a risk limit as a way to distinguish between ineffectiveness and unhedged positions. The purpose of this distinction is to identify two different types of value changes. The first one is those that would be recognized in profit or loss. This is similar to hedge ineffectiveness. And second, those value changes on risk positions that would remain unrecognized. This is similar to leaving a risk intentionally unhedged. Agenda Paper 4B provides an analysis of whether risk limits would be a possible way to link the entity's objective to hedge only a part of the risk position to the accounting model for macro hedging. The paper explains why it is difficult, honestly, to use the distinction of ineffectiveness and intentionally unhedged position in line with the common interest rate risk management view in the banking sector, also for accounting purposes. The major problems highlighted in the papers are, first, an accounting model that accommodates the risk limit concept would require departures from IFRS principles. Second, even derivatives used for trading purposes would not be measured at fair value through PL. Third, the accounting would create a moral hazard, as that more tolerant entities are to take risk position, to take open positions, the more stability profit or loss shows. Fourth, if the risk management view of whether a risk limit is breached or not is used, the issue of switch off and off of interest rate risk-related revaluation of the hedged position arises, leading to enormous operational difficulties. With it, I turn it over to the board for discussion.
Patricia.
I had some difficulty understanding this paper. I don't think it's your fault. I think it's probably mine. But is the gist of this that risk limits would replace the hedge effectiveness testing and recognition from the general hedge accounting model, that instead of using the hedge effectiveness type analysis in the general hedge accounting model, we would use an entity's own risk limits to determine what is effective and what is ineffectiveness? That's my first question. And my second question is, you mentioned that in this scenario, derivatives would not necessarily be at fair value through P&L. Is that correct? And if that's correct, why? I don't quite understand why that would be the case.
As for the first question, what I had bear in mind was that this model has nothing to do with general hedging model. What?
I'm just trying to draw an analogy.
Yeah.
So I can understand what it is it's trying to do.
What I try to analysis in this paper is just that in the macro context, it is more difficult to distinguish ineffectiveness and intentionally hedged position. But the mandate for us in considering macro hedging project is to use risk management approach to provide good information to users in terms of the failure of success, a failure and successfulness of hedging activities in the macro context. But what I try to analyze in this paper is whether I can use the concept of risk limit in, you know, distinguishing the ineffectiveness and intentional unhedge. Because usually banking industry tend to think as far as the risk limit is not breached internally, their hedging activity is successful. So this is what I just trying to, so I
think I can just summarize it. So one of the aspects we looked at is that a distinction that risk management makes for their internal purposes, whether they stay within their limits or not, which drives whether they have been or are successful. If they're within the limits, yes. If they're out of the limits, then no. Whether that could be built into the accounting model that we're looking at the moment because of what the same association that you had in terms of could it play a similar role as an effectiveness test, or could it be used as if the volatility is within this band where you think you're effective, then you don't need to worry about it because you're effective. And the paper basically says, well, if you try to do that, you would actually have to come up with a different model that is more based on deferral of derivative gains and losses, and that's usually its comment, then there would not be fair value through PL all the time anymore. And so it would be requiring a completely different model than the revaluation model we've looked at so far. And also the paper pretty much says it is also a pretty much elusive or eye of the beholder issue, whether that is ineffective or not, but we don't even need to comment on it. We don't need to make an assertion for the purposes of this revaluation model, so why get involved in that way? So we pretty much say we understand what they're doing, but we don't think it is something you can naturally and well build into this model.
Jambu?
Yeah, Patricia's, I guess it seems to me it's quite easy to understand this one comparing to general hedge accounting. So if we use strategically under hedge, as we said before at the small group meeting, if a company adopts under hedge accounting for the general hedges, but it seems to me this is quite similar to that under-hedge accounting strategy, because what Martin is saying, you know, you are not correct. This is quite different from the general hedge or macro hedge, but the effect of under-hedge or this risk limit concept is quite similar. So it seems to me, when I read this paper, you know, it's quite difficult to understand, but as Petra said, but if we make such an analogy, then, okay, there, you know, if the a bank has a strategically, generally they are all doing under-hedging account, under-hedging, and they are explaining the under-hedge accounting. But until now, those banks are not suggesting any correction of their strategic under-hedged portions recognized as some other portion, other line item. But it seems to me, and your point is quite good to make this one to general hedge accounting that may be more understandable to understand the risk limit concept, I guess.
I think the concept of underhedge is sometimes differently understood by board members, so I'm afraid to use the concept of I explain this paper in relation with the underhedge concept. But what I just wanted to try to that is, so Martin also wanted to say was that if you want to use risk, internally use risk limit idea to, as a way to resolve in distinguishing under, intentionally unhedged portion and in effectiveness, you have to use the deferral type model.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
so deferral of derivative gains and losses you'd have to accept, which massively increases the complexity of building this model, but also there is two remarks. I don't allow anyone in the hedge accounting team to use the word under or over hedge because it just results in confusion. So when we say that you leave a position unhedged, that's clear what it is, and I think that's what you probably meant, so, because there's also different use of unhedged over hedged. So if you leave something unhedged, then in the general hedge accounting model, it's very clear you cannot get hedge accounting if something is unhedged. End of the story. This one, obviously, the revaluation model is different because even if it's unhedged, as we just discussed in the previous paper, depending on what you decide, that would still have to be revalued. I think the ineffectiveness is also a completely different thing. In general hedge accounting, when you have slight mismatches, you still qualify, but those mismatches, for instance, in reset dates between a hedged item and the hedging instruments, they come through in profit or loss. In this case, they say, even if I have those mismatches that in the general hedge accounting model inevitably result in hedge ineffectiveness, as long as my volatility is within this band that I set myself, wherever I want to set it, as my risk limit, I ignore it. So it would be completely, in that case, I would be concerned actually that it opens up some arbitrage and cannibalism, and actually people use for the wrong reasons that this model, because they can actually bypass the effectiveness recognition that they would have on the general model. So I think it is really completely different, and this one is, the effectiveness decides from a risk management perspective how much and when people hedge, but the accounting model should show what they actually do, how much they have at that point in time.
Martin?
I mean, I think this paper demonstrates very clearly that it is very, very difficult to put into the risk limits into the overall model. And for me, it is really, this paper shows that, okay, what we discussed earlier, maybe it is based on a portfolio, but then it is all or nothing, but not really looking at risk limits and say, okay, that is then, if you are in risk limits, you don't have to show it. That would be very, very difficult. And I think that is the purpose of this paper. I think it is not that you propose that we should introduce risk limits into the general hedge accounting model, but it is opposite. It is really to demonstrate that it would be very, very difficult, but it's a discussion paper and we will see what the feedback is.
Yeah.
That is my takeaway from that.
Yeah. I think right at the start of the discussion, so far, I said that we'd go through the risk management approach and then decide if at some point we needed to draw the line with the extent to which we could reflect it.
Do we need to go on the left?
One of the examples.
Yeah. The fundamental difficulty is to, once risk limit is not breached, you have to assume automatic or automatic perfect hedges. So this is the we cannot find a clear, you know, line how to account for the ineffectiveness like in general hedge when you have a hedging strategy internally, when you hedge a part of the hedge risk position.
Yeah, one important message you are conveying to us is when you calculate risk limit, normally a bank is using something like a grid point sensitivity.
Yes.
So then big difference between the normal general hedge or other just revaluation model. The big difference is you are introducing the concept of sensitivity risk limit. So as far as you know the sensitivity very well and calculated it very reasonably, then you can assume that no matter what the volatility is, the sensitivity is this limit. So therefore, you can reasonably assume that this portion is within the risk limit. That kind of notion is introduced. Is the notion what you are trying to introduce? So is my understanding correct?
Yeah, it's correct. It's correct. It's correct. But my analysis here is, if you are willing to accept that idea, you have some problems in terms of the consistency with basic principles in IFRS. To make matters worse, it is operationally very difficult. So as long as you are willing to reflect actual risk management in accounting, financial statements, you have to accept bucketing idea. But in that case, you have to encounter the switch off and off, on off program. So your understanding is correct. But if you accept it, you have some problems.
Philippe?
Pretty much no more.
I think it's certainly not our job to define the way a bank should set its risk limits and the way they should hedge or not hedge totally, partially, not at all, the risk. It's not our job. It's possibly the job of prudential regulators, and even there I have some doubt as to the point to which they would be willing to go. Hence, having no definition of what is a normal way to set up the risk limit, there will be a big flexibility and diversity between banks in setting limits. As a result, the accounting will not be comparable at all, because it will all depend on the way they've set their limits. How can you compare two banks? The only way to compare would be to compare the results in connection with the risk limits as defined by the banks, which would mean to have some form of harmonized way to define risk limits setting, a kind of rating of the risk limits positions. I'm very worried about us doing that.
Yeah. So I understand how to risk limits. I think the existence of risk limits is common for major banks, but how to set these limits is quite diverse, I think. So if you are willing to this idea in accounting, you have to make it mandate for disclosures for in detail.
You can change the risk limits.
But even then, those disclosures tell you they're not comparable. Well, yeah. Thanks.
We go.
My question is just related to what you just said, last point. How the company, a bank, set risk limit.
And this is very difficult for
Asian. Yes. Hey, imagine, one possibility, I'm still on the learning curve, internally, if you look at division by division, you have the variance. Mm-hmm. But if we put them together, maybe they offset each other, and as a result, this one of the reasons?
Yeah, your question is closely related to Jane's paper, but
I think it was also between the buckets in your paper. So if you have a limit by bucket or by type of instrument, and then the overall, and then you get different results.
You look at all
the other people. I'm not so sure the practice, but it is quite hard. What I can only say to you now is that setting of risk limit for each bucket is also very diverse.
Well, the paper sets out that if you wanted to look even by bucket and then say, well, if you're within your risk limit, you're perfectly effective, well, then obviously as items mature, they change buckets, and then you also get into a horrible switch-on, switch-off problem that what was in a bucket where you were perfectly effective, so you didn't do anything, moves in a bucket where you're not, and all of a sudden, what do? So it only creates, basically, a huge friction in the model that would be unmanageable, in my view.
Okay. Are we done? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for this very interesting discussion. And we reconvene at, despite the fact that we are early, we have to reconvene at 2:15, because then the FESB will join us.